So inquiring minds want to know, you've been away from a mic for about 6 months. Do you miss it?
I terribly miss it. In fact, I actually volunteered, and that's very uncouth, I volunteered to be the MC at my brother-in-law's wedding, just so I could get near a mic again.
do you have anxiety? Is it like the story of like old men who like when they lose their limbs in the war? Do you like find that you're talking sometimes if you're brushing your hair?
I'll be at a subway station talking out loud and nobody's looking. I was like, I need a microphone because nobody's actually listening to anything I have to say.
Well, I'm happy I can help out. Welcome to Wherever You Are. I'm Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to the 44th episode of the Matinee Cast. It's the official podcast of thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. So what happens when you follow someone's content for more than a year and suddenly you find out that they're coming to your town? Well, if you're me, and obviously you're not me because I'm me, you offer to buy them a beer. The reason why you do this, whether you're me or you're not me, is that behind all this content that we record, post, and publish, there are some real people, and sometimes you'll find out that these real people are pretty damn cool and turn out to be great friends. And again, such was the case with today's guest. He was one half of the Film Cynics on CFAX out of Victoria, BC. He sometimes writes pieces extolling the awesomeness contained within the vault from Man, I Love Films. And he is a very good personal friend and very much responsible for the construction of the matinee.ca. Please welcome to the show, sitting on my right in Cassim McNeil, the man I'm supposedly romantically involved with. Have you heard this rumor?
I have not heard this rumor.
We'll talk about it later. It's Steve Johnson. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing just great, thank you. Thank you for having
me
on.
Happy to finally have you on the show. I had you in mind for so long that originally it was going to be by Skype. So it's very nice to actually have you here.
Well, yeah, and this is kind of special. I'm actually doing it in person. I guess it only makes sense since we're in the same town now.
In episode 44, we'll be discussing the Ides of March. We'll be fielding some listener feedback on my horror watching tendencies, and we'll be talking about our top 5 movie betrayals. But first, let's get to know more about Steve. This is Know Your Enemy. What was the first film you saw in the theater?
Now, people are going to say I'm actually being untruthful or deceitful about this, but yeah, my first movie experience is Star Wars.
Okay.
In 77, my dad took me to Star Wars. I was 3 years old. That's how old I am. I have sort of hazy memories of the whole experience. I do remember there were things that happened in the movie that I didn't realize until watching it again many years later.
Okay.
But I do have very vivid memories of leaving the theater and driving home in the family Corolla under the bridge in Halifax, and having the pillars of the bridge go by. It was actually more like the French Connection, but it did very much felt like the trench run in the Death Star.
Very cool. And obviously since then it's become like deeply embedded in your heart as one of the...
Yeah, I guess I'm a Star Wars disciple. I'm a very much very well versed, I think, in Star Wars lore. Although now they've kind of raised the bar on who's well aware of Star Wars.
Well, they've also changed the lore.
Well, they keep adding to it. And so like, you know, back when they were first doing Facebook groups for Star Wars and they have trivia and like, well, yeah, I know everybody who's in every single movie back and forth, but now they've opened it up to, like, all of the books and all of the TV shows and all of this other stuff. I can't keep up with all of that.
Right.
I can keep up with quite a bit of it, but I also feel that that's sort of betraying a lot of the legacy, something we'll probably
talk about later. What was the last film you saw?
It was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Mm.
And I watched it in 2 sittings on Netflix. And it's not that it was not the first time I'd seen it.
No.
But I had a real hankering to see it. I was watching it at my in-law's place on Netflix. I was getting really into it. I was very excited. And then we got to a certain scene that involves repeated use of a word that we can't actually say on the on our show. when he's at the car dealership.
Yeah.
And over and over again. And I was so nostalgic and so in the warmth of this movie that I was not even conscious of how many F-bombs they had dropped in my daughter's presence, who had wandered into the room. And that's when, like, right when he finally reached the end of his sentence, when he was asking for the effing car, oh man, and so I had to stop it, and I didn't get around to finishing the last half until I got home to Toronto and watched the last half on my iPad.
Were you watching Planes, Trains on Thanksgiving weekend?
I watched it right after.
Oh, because that would have been like meta run amok right there. What is the worst film you've ever seen?
Or Transformers 2. Transformers 2. Transformers 2, I think, would be the worst film I've ever seen. I mean, I've seen some really bad films, but this one actually has a special place in my heart just because it offended me in so many ways. Okay. It insulted my intelligence on a number of fronts. It offended me in its racist portrayals of certain characters slash robots. It also offended me in Michael Bay's disregard for the filmmaking process in that, well, I don't know for a fact this happened, but the rumor is that Michael Bay started work on the animatic sequences, the special effects sequences, before the script was even written because of the writer's strike.
Oh, really?
So that's why a lot of the stuff is like, doesn't make a lot of sense because they just had to have those special effects sequences in there, and then maybe they'll write to them. There's not a lot of documented proof of this, although it totally makes sense, and there are, like, it is true that he started work on the animatics during the strike.
Right.
So yeah, that I'm offended at that too. So what are we working with? We're working with Shia LaBeouf. We're working with Michael Bay. We weren't working with Megan Fox, or were we?
We were. She was still there.
Her there, her not there. It offends me either way.
You know what bothered me about that movie actually was the Transformers, the whole franchise, that involved a whole lot of goodwill. Because that first one just seemed like such a dumb concept of toys that were long gone that nobody was really thinking about anymore. And we, you know, we all went and we bought it, and they gave us something fun. You know, it wasn't high concept, it wasn't really all that intelligent, but at least it was fun. By the time they knew that they had us, they go and waste all that goodwill. and I'm hoping that you swore it off in time for number three.
I actually did go to number three, but it was
Steve.
It wasn't self-driven. You know, I was there with my wife, her brother, and his brother. You know, his girlfriend.
You were outvoted.
Yeah, I was outvoted. I tried to go to something else. Wasn't able to pull it off, so I sat through this thing. And meanwhile, I'm watching everybody really engage with it, and me, I was mortified.
What is a classic or essential film that you've never seen?
Well, there are a few, but
there tends to be.
I think I went for the purposes of this one, I'm going to go with Gone with the Wind. Arguably the highest grossing film, most popular film of all time.
I would not say arguably. I would say with mathematical certainty.
Yes. Well, it yes.
Butts in the seats. The way that a movie should be counted. Tickets sold over time, forever and ever. Amen. It is the only medium where that is not the counter.
Right.
You know, no other, like, books, music, nothing else is populace not counted that way. So, butts in the seats, it is the biggest attraction of all time to this day.
Yes.
So. But not you being among
them. I'm not part of that. I am the 1%.
Okay.
And I have not seen it. And, I mean, I regret it in a way, but at the same time, there's so much of it that I know about and so many little bits that I've seen that really bother me. Scarlett's personality seems to really bother me. I don't know if I can endure
a full
3 hours of her.
She's a twit.
Yes. I mean, I don't have patience for that.
No.
I mean, these are the reasons, right? So I'd rather not deal with that. The important parts of it I have seen. I mean, I guess the big closing line of it is the big deal, or the whole her saying she'll have the place back again. All of the elements that I haven't seen of the movie, I have seen in The Simpsons in some form or fashion. Whether it's Skinner saying he's going to have the school back, or whether they've changed the line at the end of the movie for seniors. I love you. Let's remarry. There's all kinds of things that I know about it.
Right.
Much in the same way with Planet of the Apes. I knew everything about Planet of the Apes from The Simpsons, and so when I finally saw it, I could feel the way Bart did as he's watching the musical version of it. Like, wow, this movie has everything. And it really did. I think if I was not in a position to be into Charlton Heston, I wouldn't have been able to get into it without The Simpsons.
Well, as people may or may not know, I am not a big fan of Gone with the Wind, so you will not be hearing me to press it upon you. You know, I will not be sending you home with a home copy. There's not even one here to lend you. I have a lot of respect for it. There's a lot of things I like for it, and there's a lot of films that were deeply, deeply influenced by it. But it's at its core, its story. Just there's a lot there that I just don't follow. So you're okay. Like you say, you know the points. If you ever needed to like research it for something,
right,
then I'm sure you'd have no problem with it.
Plenty of material out there to draw from.
Exactly. You know, or anytime you had 4 hours and you just couldn't move.
Yeah. So it's important to have these things under your belt so you can have a complete discussion about the cinematic world in its entirety. So yeah, sometimes everybody out there can know they can take my my episcling with a grain of salt.
Very nice. And last but not least, what is a film that for any reason you wish you had made?
I approached this question in two different ways. From what I know about the filmmaking process now, from having been taken part in it and analyzed it greatly and gone to school for it and all these things, there's a mystique about it that is lost on me. So if I was to look at it from a childlike wonder perspective,
okay.
I would have loved to have been in Star Wars or maybe been part of Harry Potter. Just gotcha. To like, because there's magic everywhere and the things going on, and I would love to hold a lightsaber. But as a film grad and as a critic and all these things, I think I have three, actually, not just one.
Jeez.
But I'm going to go through them quickly.
Okay.
So Apocalypse Now.
No argument here.
To see just how bad it can get.
Oh, yeah.
From the alongside of a master of filmmaking.
Yeah.
arguably like a former master of filmmaking. Baron Munchausen.
Really?
The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. To see my hero, Terry Gilliam is my favorite director.
You would be there to like hold lights.
Well, I would be there to like hold his coffee. I would do whatever. Just to behold the him at the height of his power. I know he did bigger films, but this was where he had the most money,
right.
The least studio involvement, because this is before anybody realized that he's not really everyone's cup of tea.
Yeah.
So he could do no wrong at the time. So it would have been great to sort of be witness to that.
Okay.
And also just to be around all the people who were part of the film, including Sarah Pauly, who I think we were the same age, so...
No, she's closer to my age. She's younger than me.
We would have had an onset.
And I'm younger than you. Yes, you would have.
It would have been legal, too.
I'm sure.
And finally...
Thank you.
Finally, Lord of the Rings. Just in that place is... It bridges that gap of the wonder aspect with the practical aspect of actually being in this place where this was made. So to actually bear witness to a great film being made, but also in this incredible location.
Well, there we go. That's more about Steve, and that's time for me to hear more about you. This is your chance to come talk to me. Why are you shaking like a leaf? Come on, come talk to me. Please talk to me. Won't you please talk to me? Well, if you have dropped by the matinee in the last few weeks, you would have seen a post with a iconic image from Evil Dead 2 called Get Your Freak On, and it describes my lack of horror movie know-how. Yeah, I have a gigantic blind spot for horror films, in part because I'm a wuss, in part just because of my own taste, and in part just because there's only so many hours to watch films in the day. So a long, long list had been compiled, and I asked people... Which of these films should I bump up the queue? I'll read some of the reactions, and then I'll get back to this in a second. So Courtney Small, our friend from Big Thoughts from a Small Mind, you've met him.
Yes, yeah. I have.
He recommended Wreck, saying that he actually needed to see it as well. He's a really, really big fan of Quarantine. Did you see Wreck?
I have not seen Wreck. Sorry, I've got a brownie in my mouth. I have not seen Wreck. I have not seen Quarantine. I understand that they are the same film. From different countries.
It's the Americanized version of Wreck. Mm-hmm. And thank you, Courtney. I have taken that to heart, and I have actually watched Wreck on his recommendation. I got a new reader, possibly listener. I don't know if she actually listens to the show. But Helen from CommentaryTrack.com recommended Cat People, the original 1950-something Cat People in black and white. She said it's really good. It's really short. And I would not be just striking out a single title. I'd be putting a check mark next to an entire horror film subcategory. What that subcategory is, I'm not entirely sure how I would possibly qualify Cat People, except to say that it's old weird.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have not seen the film, although that comment when I read it has stuck with me. I really have been thinking about it and thinking like, wow, what is the subcategory and how can I strike it?
Yeah. What it is it kind of bridges the gap between really old universal Dracula, Frankenstein, Creature in the Black Lagoon eeriness.
Okay.
And getting into actual psychological freakiness, you know, like the kind of thing
sort
that
screws... Sort of like the Peeping Tom?
Yeah, well, that kind of thing, but it's you're watching a whole thing where you've got this overwhelming sense that what you're watching is just not right. There's something not right about what you're seeing, and you can't really put your finger on it, but it's unnerving. And the way that people are acting, the way that people are talking are very, very unnerving. And it's one of that kind of film where it wants to throw you off, not necessarily by what you're seeing, by just putting a person in the room that if you were in the room too, you might say, I got to go take a call. And so yeah, it was very, very cool. And I did get to watch that as well. Andrew James from Row 3 and the Row 3 Cinecast suggested Evil Dead 1 and 2 because you can't be a movie nerd and not have seen these.
They're the same movie, though. You don't have to see both.
Apparently 2 is better, though.
Is better. Well, that's what I'm saying.
So then you got to see them both. And you can't just jump right into 2.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe you can. Matthew Brown from the Mammo podcast demanded, and I mean like he was banging the table, demanded Nightmare on Elm Street 3. He said it's essential. Essential! Like there's like 4 exclamation marks after his comment. It is some genuinely freaky shit, and it probably scared me more than any other single movie except The Secret of NIMH.
Oh my God. We can talk a little bit about my worst parent of the year and that I showed Secret of NIMH to my 4-year-old daughter a few weeks ago.
When I was growing up, and again, he slapped the table. We got this long Bible of a list in front of us here, and through everybody's comments, both directly and in conversations and on the post, the ones that came up most often were Evil Dead 1 and 2, Cat People, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and Poltergeist.
Ah, Poltergeist.
And Rec was the other one. So I have since watched Rec, which I really enjoyed. Poltergeist, it hasn't aged particularly well, but it's still really creepy.
Right.
The old little woman really gave me the heebie-jeebies.
Okay.
And I have not yet watched the others. I have Evil Dead 1 sitting over there to watch. I will get my hands on Evil Dead 2 before Halloween, I'm promising people.
Okay.
So by the time, probably just after the show goes up, I'll watch Evil Dead 2. And Nightmare 3 might take some doing, because my regular place didn't have it.
Really?
Yeah. Well, did you see one of these that jumped out at you in particular?
Okay, well...
Or do you have a comment on this whole point of my film literacy?
I'm in the same boat as you. Like, I'm really? Not a horror guy. I'm not really into horror, which is why I studied horror in film school. Like, I took a special course on it just so I could get myself better versed.
That's pretty cool.
In some of the ideas behind it. So there's a lot of films in here that, some real canon bits here. Dog Soldiers and the Descent, I think, are both very important to see. I'm a big fan of Neil Marshall. And this is, I think, these are his 2 best films. But let's just move on to The Descent, which is mostly about spelunking slash caving.
Yeah.
There's the subtext within there that sort of deals with like women with women and how women are, are able to form these really strong relationships.
I like the sound of this already. I might have to move this up the queue.
At the same time, it really deals with that frenemy thing, the whole Mean Girls thing.
A whole different movie going in my head.
Like, these women all depend on each other and they're very close, but at the same time, they're doing horrible things to each other. Just in a general day-to-day sense. And not to mention whatever's going on inside this cave that they get stuck in. And then the whole thing about the cave and like the idea of like the cave is like the womb and so they're all, there's a whole feminine body thing that's going on as they're crawling through this.
Okay.
And then there's the whole thing about all these freaky things that are actually living underground in this place where they get stuck in, which sort of represents the other. It also represents maybe the unborn and all this other stuff. So really cool ideas that are presented.
But is it scary?
It's definitely freaky.
Okay.
I'm not very claustrophobic. I mean, if I get stuck somewhere, I probably get a little bit uncomfortable.
Okay.
But there are scenes where they're crawling through very small crevices and you are freaking out because you realize, like, you're sort of putting yourself in their shoes and they can't go forward, they can't go back. What are they going to do if they get stuck there?
Okay.
Very tense.
Okay, so of everything here, like, it really sounds like you're on board for The Descent. Is that like your numero uno choice, or is there other one other that I should try and get in while the iron is hot?
Because
right now the iron is hot. I'm going through these quite a bit.
From this list, I would stay away from Thirst, only because it's too freaky as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
Chan-wook Park freaks me out. He is very strange. Like, so like South Korean cinema just is crazy to me.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, I'm a big fan of his films as far as being powerful, but thirst is just too powerful as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. I see. Well, my feedback question for next time, and thank you, everybody. I am enjoying watching a lot of these freaky movies. None of them are scaring me to the point where I'm having nightmares. A lot of them are – some of them are screwing me up. Some of them are just great watches. Some of them age better than others. Thank you very much for guiding me in my blind spot here. My question for next time actually specifically involves this show. I'm wondering what people's thoughts are regarding when we get into the feature discussion, the new slang, we talk about the main review. I'm wondering people's thoughts on spoilers, because it seems to me that most people who listen to the show, if they listen to the review, they've already seen the film. I'm noticing more and more and more people, certainly who listen to this, if not who just, you know, are the kind of person who would listen to this, they're shying away from details and even the possibility of details. So my thinking is, if you're listening to the review, you've either already seen the film or you haven't heard about it, and maybe we can actually talk a little bit deeper into it than this show tends to do. So I want to know, what are people's ideas regarding spoilers within the feature discussion? Should I start doing them? Should I keep them out? Today we're going to be doing a little bit. Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, facebook.com/darkmatinee, or on Twitter, where you can find me at matinee_CA. And that takes us to the new slang. The new slang for episode 44 is the Ides of March.
Give me strength, reserve, control. Give me heart and give me soul. Time, give us a kiss. Tell me your politics.
Well, we are going to get a little bit spoilery regarding the Ides of March. So if you haven't seen this, you might want to check the info track and skip ahead to the next section. It's kind of hard to talk about this film and not get spoiler-esque. The Ides of March is directed by George Clooney. The screenplay is by Clooney as well, with Grant Heslov and Bo Williamson. It's based on his play called Fargo North. It stars Ryan Gosling, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Clooney again, Paul Giamatti, Marissa Tomei, Jeffrey Wright, and Evan Rachel Wood. Long story short, on Ides of March, George Clooney plays Mike Morris. He's running for the Democratic nomination for presidency. Clooney's campaign is being run by Ryan Gosling and Phil Seymour Hoffman, and they've got a whole team of underlings underneath them, and they're trying to get him. He's this very idealistic Democratic candidate on the ticket for president. And it turns out that getting somebody elected for the Democratic nomination is not as easy as you would think. So, Steve, what did you think of Ides of March?
I very much liked it. Even though it's not my cup of tea, it's not my kind of movie. I don't tend to
you
watch.
You don't do political? Or
it's as a political thriller, which I guess it sort of is, it doesn't really have a lot of politics. It has a lot of behind-the-scene politics.
Yes.
Which I did like about it. But like I was saying, it's not necessarily my kind of film, although I liked it for a couple of reasons. One, I'm a big fan of Ryan Gosling these days.
You're digging the baby goose?
He's doing quite well for himself.
He's having quite a year.
I'm also a fan of George Clooney, more so as an actor than a director, although, I mean, he does a good job, even if I don't like the work that he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like... Good night and good luck.
Oh, no, no. This show's over.
Well, and I worked, that's
hearsay.
I worked in news for like 10 years.
I don't care.
But that being said, I liked what I saw in this movie from a sort of intrigue perspective. I liked the way that everything was really set up against themselves. Like, the symmetry that was going on between the two competing campaigns, especially the symmetrical balance between Paul Giamatti and Philip Seymour Hoffman. They are so well matched.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they really don't share a lot of screen time together.
I think they've got one scene.
But it's so clear how well matched they are as Ryan Gosling sort of goes back and forth between the two of them, as I illustrate with my finger back and forth on the desk.
I really like this film, actually. I do believe that part of it had to do with my experience of it. I was lucky enough to see this at TIFF, and I had not seen a trailer, nothing. Coming into this blind and letting it all just play out blind and watching it, what it did for me was, this is the kind of movie I wish they made more of, because this is very much a movie for grown-ups, which, you know, we are. So as much as I want to pretend otherwise.
I can't wait till I'm old enough to watch this movie.
Yeah. So I do like Clooney's direction. I'm actually a very big fan of Good Night and Good Luck. And his first film, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Yes.
Which I like them both. I could really see his construction and his direction in the scenes certainly in the dialogue, because while these are some very, very talented actors who are all playing off each other, you could probably just turn on a camera and let Hoffman and Giamatti talk over the craft services cart, and it would be a great conversation. But there still needs to little be, you know, some guidance to that. And I in scene after scene, I could really see just, you know, what you were trying to go for in terms of every conversation, because they're all very similar. They're very similar in terms of how everybody's talking to each other, because nobody really seems to be talking to each other personally.
Right.
It's almost all business. Even when it should be personal, it's still business. And I'm thinking about some of the later conversations between Gosling and Evan Rachel Wood, which we'll get back to. You know, they got some great personal chemistry. And especially early on, there's a scene where they're kind of off on a date. And it's kind of a hot little scene.
Yeah, it is.
On top of that, just visually, like you were talking about the symmetry of these scenes, this film is pretty. There is what right now is one of the shots of the year for me, where Clooney as the candidate is out front on a stage giving one of his rally speeches, and backstage in this moment that seems to encapsulate the whole movie, the guys are talking they're in silhouette behind the flag. So you've got this American flag, and it's just they're in the bars, they're in the red and the white, and they're in silhouette, and it's this whole thing that behind every patriotic, standing for your country candidate, there are these shadowy people doing shadowy things who got them there. And you get, you know, that kind of moment just really, really summed up the film. I love this movie.
I thought it was interesting, the intrigue that was going on as far as how people are thinking a couple of moves in advance, mm-hmm. and how that really, I mean, I was actually kind of stunned at how clever some of the writing was as far as how clever they made the characters.
Yeah.
The forethought that was going into some of the conversations these people were having. You were saying about like how they were having personal discussions that were impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
Even when in the scene where they're all at the bar, so it's Philip Seymour Hoffman,
yeah.
Marissa Tomei, and Ryan Gosling, they're at the bar, they're talking, they're palling around.
Right.
And even as they're palling around, it's business.
Yeah.
And Gosling's sort of he's still in his idealistic mode. He's still fairly naive, especially for a press secretary. He is under the impression that there's a friendship going on, and is there a friendship? And as we go throughout the film, we realize that all of these friendships, none of them are actually real. Even some of the most tender moments that you would think, like when Gosling and Evan Rachel Wood have to go someplace together, that there's still an impersonal element there. It's still
there's always a motive. There's always a business related motive to your personal decisions.
Yeah. There are a lot of revelations that come at the end that sort of put everything back into perspective of how you see what people's motivations were. But yes, throughout it all, it's everybody is out for something.
So it's kind of funny because you mentioned, you know, what is Marissa Tomei doing here? That's actually one of the things I like about this movie, is it could have been very, very simple to cast that part to some lesser known, somebody who's going to be less expensive, somebody who maybe they're trying to make the jump from TV, and this is kind of a small part that they could really kind of sink their teeth into. But I actually really like that these smaller parts like that, or like Jeffrey Wright as the senator who they need. Even the guy who plays Evan Rachel Wood's father,
Gregory Itzen from 24.
Exactly. Like he's got what, three lines? Getting these kind of people, Max Minghella, who we last saw in The Social Network, he's like the number four guy on the totem pole. He's the guy who's like underneath Gosling.
Yeah.
So getting these kinds of actors into this kind of film, Jennifer Eale, who we saw in Contagion, I applaud that. I applaud that these kind of actors would come on to do these smaller parts because it's a project they believe in, or because they want to work with Clooney, or just because they think it could be a lark. You know, there are no small parts. Who said that? Was that Shakespeare? Oscar Wilde?
My mother.
It might have been the doorman. So that's the funny thing is, yeah, on the surface, what is Marissa Tomei doing in this movie? Not all that much.
No.
She's got four scenes. She's got one motivation, which we could probably figure out just based on the fact that she's a journalist.
Yes.
And, you know, she's just kind of there to stir up shit. But the fact that it's Marissa Tomei doing it, and that she is now kind of on this really wild second act of her career,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I'm buying into. For me, it's little decisions like that that made this movie.
there's this whole other, like, the, I don't know if it's necessarily subtext, but it's something that really doesn't get spoken about in the movie out loud, but within the media campaign for it, like the poster with the, like, you know, the half face, is this the face of the president? Also the first 5 minutes of the film as we are doing a mic check, and we have Ryan Gosling talking, saying he wants to be president, he wants to run for president, and it, you know, he's like, we're getting a window into the character that we actually won't hear from him at all again, because it actually has really nothing to do with anything else that's going on as far as what we see specifically. But it's this hidden undertones of the film that are really talking about, like, this duality. It's like, so what is Ryan Gosling? Are we seeing Ryan Gosling as the press secretary, or are we seeing his future self, you know, as the next cycle happens? I don't want to bring things too much to television, but I felt I felt a real connection to The Wire with this film.
Okay.
Excuse me. The Wire, I mean, for one of the things that this has in common with The Wire is that there's a certain behind-the-scenes look, an unglamorous behind-the-scenes look that it takes at how the process works. Everybody's familiar with the campaign and some of the things that go on with it. This gets, I thought, went a little bit deeper.
Yeah.
Even to the point of ad nauseum almost at times, even though it was still riveting because it was well shot and well performed. There were details of it that you're sort of like, eh, you know, I don't think I'd ever really see that. And The Wire does that as well. But the big thing that The Wire does, and at the end of every season, and then at the end of the entire, like, five seasons.
Easy now. I'm only on season one.
Is what is known in news as the big donut, as in everything just ties back to the beginning and shows the cycle. And so you have, okay, well, what's going to happen next? Well, actually, this has all happened before, and this will all happen again. And so there's a certain, like, snake eating its tail within the Ides of March as the cycle begins again. We see, you know, what's going to happen with the candidate, what's going to happen with the staff, what's going to happen with the junior staff, and where is this all going? Well, you know, this has all happened before, it'll all happen again.
This whole film, it's, I don't mean this in a bad way, it's melodrama.
Yep.
And it relies on really two turns. I wouldn't even call them a twist, I call them turns, because it goes off one way and then it goes back another way and then we go to the end. What did you think of either one or both of those two turns? The first one obviously becoming when he gets the phone call, or sorry, when he returns the phone call specifically. The second one really comes when we find out that she's killed herself. So, and everything just kind of goes out from there.
First turn, I was just waiting. I had spent this whole time waiting. It's like, really? So when is that shoe going to drop? Because, like, everything's so perfect. The candidate is so idealistic. The campaign is great. His career rises meteoric, you know? Their relationship seems really smoking hot. I mean, all this stuff is going, like, oh, this is so great. Well, wait a second. This is not, like, this is definitely not the kind of film that George Clooney would make. So when is that shoe going to drop? And then that was it. And it happened at the most restful period, you know, as they sort of post-coitus, you know, hanging out. And so this is when it had to happen.
Right.
As far as the last turn, I was actually, I felt rewarded. Okay. I felt that my patience in sitting through it was just so rewarded in that it actually took me by surprise at how well the chess pieces were set up. It all depended on expecting the worst from these people.
Right.
And just when that happens, like, well, this guy's very idealistic. Why would he do something bad like that? And then you realize at that moment that, oh, wait a second. All these people have been out for themselves the whole time. So, of course, he's going to do the thing that is not idealistic.
I really liked that first term because I thought, you know, here we are playing the virtuous candidate, the one who is trying to look out for everybody. You know, he's very much like an Obama type character. 2008, not so much now, but the guy, you know, you see the posters behind him. They're done by Shepard Fairey. They look very much like the Hope one. They might as well say Hope at the bottom of them. I can't remember what that one word is that they do say. First of all, it's that showing that no matter how much you believe in him, because we hear Ryan Gosling talk about how much this guy is the real deal. This is the guy who's actually going to get shit done. And you find out, no, sorry. You know, first of all, to yank the rug out like that, that I was good with. I actually really like that. The second turn, while I love this movie, I wasn't so fussed about that. That I could have done without, and the only reason why that is saved is because everything else that comes after is it kind of brings it back to no matter what horrible, deplorable shit we have done in the past, we can always take care of ourselves and bury it, almost literally bury it. And so while I wasn't really fussed with the very almost cliche moment of her taking her own life, what the fallout from that was, I thought, like, the effect outweighed the cause for me. Well, we have almost talked this to death, so we'll get out of this kind of quick. Given all of the bounty that is the Ides of March, if you were to take one thing away as your souvenir to keep from this film, what would you take?
Well, I know my wife's never going to listen to this, so I'm going to say that date with Evan Rachel Wood.
Yeah, okay, that is a very good scene, that is for sure. And
the whole thing, all of it.
You know what I started wondering in that moment, actually, is I'm wondering if Gosling is bringing this out in people. Because he had the same kind of chemistry with Emma Stone in Crazy Stupid Love. And I'm wondering, like, it could just be that he, you know, it could just be fluke. It could just be coincidence.
Evan Rachel Wood in True Blood, that's the Evan Rachel Wood I was seeing. Not Evan Rachel
True Blood.
Not Evan Rachel Wood from The Wrestler. Evan Rachel Wood as the queen of Louisiana in True Blood.
Gotcha. Spoilers for True Blood, by the way. For me, it's a line. For me, when we were talking about that scene in the beginning, when Marissa Tomei and Phil Seymour Hoffman and they're all sitting around the table with the baby goose, and they're talking, and she said, there's a great line. She says, "Wow, you really have drunk the Kool-Aid." And he says, "I have drunk the Kool-Aid. It's delicious." I love that line. That is a fantastic line. So in the end of it all, on a scale of 1 to 4, Steve Johnson, what do you give Ides of March?
I give it a tray.
You give it a 3?
Yeah.
Okay. For me, it's a 4. I enjoyed this from end to end. It was unexpected. It was not the kind of political movie that I thought I was signing on for. And as I said, those visual elements and that you know, whole everybody's looking out for number one didn't really have any expectations of any of that. So it was a delightful surprise. And I don't think it's necessarily going to make my like top 5 of the year.
No.
But it is one of the best films I've seen this year for sure. We could both be crazy. You could have hated it. Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca or Facebook, Twitter, you know it. We're going to get on and do our top 5 and get out of this episode. This is The Best of You. Of course, the Ides of March is the allusion with an A, to the classic betrayal of Caesar and being aware of the Ides of March, and that was the date he was assassinated. Today's history lesson has been brought to you by thematinee.ca. So we thought that we would do something a little bit different, and we would talk about our moments of movie betrayal. Now, we're not talking about great scenes of betrayal in a film. We are talking about personal betrayal, where for one reason or another, we were let down in spectacular fashion in horrendous, horrendous ways, which only nerds of Steve and I could possibly quantify. You didn't actually rank these, did you?
I did, but I don't have to.
Okay.
I'm gonna save my big one for last, I
think. Okay, we'll go with that then. So what then is your first moment of movie betrayal?
X-Men First Class. How could you? How could you?
Are we still on that?
Yes,
it almost feels like we've been talking about that since you got to town.
It bothers me so much how that happened. And you know, I only, as you'll notice on my notes, it's only written in pen because it only came to me today. Now, I was going to go with a different thing, but I went with this because it really still smarts. And it actually is representative of how I feel about like superhero films, comic book films. They are adaptations of established, well-loved material. As is the X-Men, I've been an X-Men fan for years and years and years. Decades, actually. Why would a studio buy a property, buy the franchise, and then not actually use it accurately? I mean, fine, it's theirs, they paid for it, they can do whatever they want with it. Mm-hmm. But why would you not use the property the way it was? Fox buys it. Fox has to keep making movies in order to keep the property. If they don't make a movie every 2 years, it goes back to Marvel Comics, and then Marvel can finally make a movie where the Avengers meet the X-Men. That would be awesome.
Yes, it would.
So, they are forced to keep making these. Whether they're good ideas or bad ideas, Fox doesn't care. Just get them out there.
Right.
So, what they do is they take existing canon that they've established within the actual franchise of the studio, and they walk all over it. Suddenly, Mystique is Xavier's brother. Like, whatever happened to Juggernaut is Charles's brother. Like, Charles Xavier and Cain Marco are actually brothers. It made no mention of that in the third movie, which, of course, apparently, according to this, never even happened. Unbelievable. And, like, the whole thing, Jean Grey was the first student. Where's Jean Grey in this movie? I don't know. Oh, and Alex Summers is in this movie. What about his brother Scott Summers? No mention of him. So much of it bothered me.
I wish listeners could see how worked up.
And this is my number five. So
I know. I was going to say, and we've had this conversation for months now. Did it remind you because it's on Blu-ray now? Is that what, like, you just got settled down and then you were in a future shop and it was like, oh, man.
Well, and Michael Fassbender was in my presence not so long ago and I thought I was going to slap him. If they had done that Magneto film on its own, that would have been awesome. It would have been Magneto Nazi Hunter, and it would have been a super cool movie. But instead, they had to turn it into something else.
I still enjoyed it. I had fun. You know what? To bring this back around, I'm sure I would bet dollars to donuts I'm going to go through something very, very similar next year when we see Superman. Yep. I wager my entire listenership that I will be in that same position, that no matter how much a lot of other people enjoy it, that is going to have problems for me because I'm coming in as a big fan of the property.
Have faith in Zack Snyder and have faith that the other half of the film cynics will be working on that film.
Okay, I have faith in that. That's
Brian
okay.
Dukovich hopefully will be working on that film.
Hi, Brian. Hope you're listening. Well, for me, my first one, it's kind of a serves me right moment, and it really kind of calls back to something that used to happen that I did not expect at all. My first moment, it's also from this summer, and actually it was a week before the X-Men. My first movie betrayal is The Hangover 2. Now, I'm not the world's biggest Hangover fan. I thought it was funny. I don't quote it. I don't imagine myself as part of a wolf pack. None of that. It amused me. The end. I saw, okay, you're going to take the same thing. We're going to move it to Thailand. We're going to have further adventures. No. We're going to have the same adventure. We are going to go note for note like we did originally. Now, on the one hand, it serves me right because I should have seen this kind of stupidity coming. But on the other hand, this was the kind of crap they used to do to us in the 80s and the 90s. You had a successful film.
Why change it?
Just do it again. That's all the sequels were. Part 2s, part 3s, part 4s. Just take what you did the first time and do it all over again the same. Just kind of mix and match out the parts. I'd been lulled into a state of believing in the studios that they had stopped doing stuff again when they ran sequels into the ground with Rocky 500 and Superman 600 and so on and so on, you know, Short Circuit to Crocodile Dundee 3, so on and so on and so on.
Yeah, but The Hangover actually fits into that 80s format to begin with.
I know, but still, like, that's not to say that you can take these guys, put them in a different city, just let madness ensue, because lest we forget, these are funny dudes.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Jeong, Zach Galifianakis, Ed Helms, these are guys who make me laugh constantly. Why in the world would you think that you just had to go note for note again? And I could tell, like, the moment we got into them waking up from the hangover, and it was the same way that they woke up from the first hangover, I had that mental, uh-oh, moment.
Yeah.
I had that red flag, just buzzers going off, going, I have just made a great, big mistake. And I felt just so ripped off at that point. And unfortunately, it was too long into it that I couldn't go get my money back.
Look, a film of that caliber is not going to take chances. It's just not.
Why?
Because it's not a film that's out to break barriers. It's not a film that's out to try something new to begin with.
You don't have to try something new. Just don't do what you did before. Just don't try something old.
Yeah, but that works so well for them. So why wouldn't they do that?
That was my first real betrayal. And in that case, I really had nobody to blame but myself.
Yeah.
So what's your next one?
This is one probably people don't, I was saying people don't even know about this film. It's called Formula 51. It's directed by Ronnie Yu, made in 2001. It stars Samuel Jackson and Robert Carlyle. It seems like a cast made in heaven. It's a British crime caper that involves Sam Jackson is a pharmacologist who's got the secret formula 51 to take you to the 51st state of consciousness. And everybody wants a piece of this formula.
There's 50 states of consciousness?
Apparently there are. Okay. At least, it's a clever play on the United States identity, I suppose, because
most of
this film has to do with culture clash between United States and the UK, playing up, I guess, on Avi's visit to London in Snatch, which happened a year prior. I had such high hopes because it had Sam Jackson in a kilt beating skinheads with a golf club. It also had Robbie Carlyle, who I best knew at the time from Trainspotting, and I guess the Full Monty, right. And also from a very special episode of Cracker, which I was a big fan of. Everybody should see Cracker. It had all this potential. It looked like it was going to be a totally winning combination, but it fell right on its face. The story was stupid. The execution was hackneyed, and trying to be too clever, trying to be too much like other films, but not really knowing how. And I went there with a whole bunch of friends from college. Convinced them to come with me. So I was left embarrassed. I was left holding the bag, and it's like everybody's looking at me because we're all film students and we're all trying to strut our stuff and say that we know what we're talking about. So I was left embarrassed by this stupid film. This is sort of like I only have myself to blame. I guess I just didn't know enough about films at the time.
Well, when was that? Do you remember the year?
2001.
So, you know, Rotten Tomatoes was around.
I don't know what to tell you. I was in film school at the time. Like, I mean, this is just why it stings all the more. I'm always wary of this now when I'm taking people to film that I don't really know enough about. And so that's maybe why I research a little bit more in advance nowadays.
And it would have been one thing if you had a dug it. You and I have both gotten into conversations where you're taking on like a whole table of people.
Yeah.
Who don't like something, but you do. But if you're finding out for the first time,
yes,
it
smacks.
That's not fair. You know, it had all the tropes. It had the earmarkings of something great. It just, I haven't seen it, and given what you're saying, I don't think I ever will. So Formula 51, that is certainly a heavy, heavy betrayal. My next one, I don't know if you'll recall this. When I was on the Film Cynics, you asked me, like, what is my film going habit or what is my movie watching habit? And I said to you at the time, I believe in theatrical experience. And I still do.
Yeah.
No. Well,
you and Ryan both.
That's fair enough. But I am a firm believer in dramas, foreign films, documentary, whenever possible. The theatrical experience will trump it because your phone is off, your distractions are minimal, you're zeroed in, you're drowning in the film because it's bigger than you. So, with that in mind, a few weeks ago, I had the chance to do the theatrical experience on Red State, Kevin Smith's new film.
Right.
Okay. Now, I didn't care for it, but that is not the betrayal. You run that risk any time. This is not The Hangover. Where I was betrayed is the fact that Red State, first of all, it comes out on DVD this week. This was 3 weeks ago. It comes out on DVD this week. Comes out on demand the week after. So I am paying down my hard earned to see this in a larger than life environment. And for my hard earned, I got some of the worst sound I have ever heard in my life. It sounded like it was a mono mix pumped through a 7.1 surround. So if you have no idea what I'm talking about, there was no separation of the audio at all.
So it's just optical track on the
That's phone, what it maybe? Sounded like.
You didn't bring a disc with the audio on.
I guess not. The audio, it all sounded like it was basically coming from opposite corners, actually. It sounded like it was coming from the front right and the back left. It made no sense to what was going on in the film. There are gunshots aplenty in this film, and none of them rang. Like, gunshots now, you go to a movie, they ring. They got that kind of echo of a gunshot ringing. None of them. Not one. The dialogue sounded terrible. And I could tell that it wasn't the fault of the filmmaker, because even Smith does this little intro at the beginning of the film. Like, there's, well, hi, I'm Kevin Smith. Thanks for coming out to Red State. And even that sounded like crap. I thought it was just that. I thought I was like, oh, this is kind of a bad intro. And like, and what was worse was that the color was off too. This film, it's low budge, and it's given these filters to kind of look edgy and realistic and whatnot that they're doing now, it wasn't, again, it wasn't that. It wasn't something deliberate that I didn't care for. Everything looked overexposed, first of all, so they were showing it too bright, which is weird at the movies these days, and yellow, so the color balance was off. So I'm thinking to myself, let me see if I got this straight. I just paid for big screen, big sound for something I could have watched at home, perfectly balanced and nicely sound next week, and you're not going to give me that. That, to me, that's a knife in the back right there. I just gave you money for something I could have kicked in like 10 more bucks and bought.
Right. So you're anxious not necessarily directed at the film so much as
at that theater, at that presentation, because it was a one-night-only thing, too. It wasn't like I had any other shots at it that I could have gone home and, like, I could have gone down to the guy and said, I want my money back because this looks like crap. It was see it that night in the theater or I had to wait.
Right.
So that was my own habit of going to the theater, working against me, and deeply, deeply betrayed. What's your next betrayal?
And now this should, I think, be on everybody's list, I guess, or at least on people who are around my age, and that is The Phantom Menace.
Okay.
I think that nowadays people look back and they're like, nobody's really surprised at hearing that George Lucas can't direct a film. But this was how everybody got finally led on to it. Everybody finally got realized this is why it's been so long since he's directed a film, is that he really has no idea how to do so. There was so much buzz and so much anticipation going into this movie. I mean, I think people will find it hard to believe that there was a period of time where Star Wars fandom was driven only by the memory of such.
Right.
The torch was carried by a generation because they had such warm memories of it. The release of Phantom Menace betrayed that whole thing because it was just so terrible. The acting was worse than anybody remembered. The special effects were used, I think, in a capricious way, if that's the right word to describe it. It was just sort of scornful almost how they bombarded with all these special effects. But the worst thing of it all, and I go on about this quite a bit, is that everybody's response to George Lucas being a racist and how upset he was. He just couldn't understand what he had done differently. I mean, I'm not a racist. I'm doing the exact same thing I always did. The thing he did was that he didn't have his aliens speak an alien language.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you get them to speak English, then you have to give them an accent. And you got to give them all the same accent because you're trying to give them, like, apparently they're all from the same neighborhood. So, of course, the greedy Trade Federation guys have to be Japanese. It was ridiculous. So if he had managed to actually give them all an alien language to speak, like he did in the first three, then we would have been able to avoid a lot of these stupid racist scenes with the goofy Jamaican alien and the greedy Jewish alien and all these other things. So I was just betrayed on a whole bunch of fronts. It was an affront to my memories as a kid, and it was an insult to the people who had actually been carrying the torch of this franchise for all this time.
Now, does it throw you off that there are lots and lots of people who actually dig The Phantom Menace?
Yeah, they just don't know any better.
You know what it is? They're much younger.
Yes.
Than you and I.
They don't know any better.
Well, no, it was just, okay, like, imagine, I'll give you, for instance, imagine if you took your daughter to see that, and that was her version of what you went through with The New Hope.
Right.
It would play very, very differently to her. Now, I guarantee you that 20 years later, when she went back and watched it, she'd be like, what the hell? But that was the weirdest thing, is that to a lot of people who were of a certain age, it played. Given what Lucas must have known about the love for his property, given the amount of vast resources at his disposal, you're right. For him to take that much of a time out in the wilderness and come back with something that subpar, because even I can't say, watch it again. I go through that with bands. There are certain, you know, there are some bands that come out with an album every year, and if it's a miss, oh well, you just wait till the next one and it's a little bit better. If a band is gone for 3 or 4 or 5 years and they come back and that wait was not justified and they come back with something lackluster, and you're thinking, I got to wait another 4 or 5 years before you're going to give me something to erase the memory of this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I do get you. So that one must have cut deep. I will say. My next betrayal was Spider-Man 3.
Yeah.
Now, Spider-Man 2, first of all, it elevated the property because the first one was okay.
Yeah, first one was pretty first good.
It was at the time we were still bending our brain around the Uncanny Valley and computer graphics. So anytime Spidey was swinging or jumping or whatnot, it looked very digital.
Yeah.
Watch part one now and oh baby. Spider-Man 2, just a mere 2 years later.
Yeah.
Upped the ante across the board. Like, you know, the story was better. The acting somehow got better.
Yeah.
Okay, even though it's almost everybody the same.
And there were some good parts where Raimi could really be Raimi.
Exactly. You know, it got so very much better that at the time, it was probably the best comic book offering we'd had. So then we get to Spider-Man Part 3. You're bringing in Venom. So he's a divisive character, first of all, but he has the potential to be something interesting within the film.
Yeah.
And you're building off of what you have already done. And for them to drop the ball so spectacularly badly on that film that is overlong, just throws so many villains in and commits the cardinal sin of A, putting too many bad guys into one soup, and B, killing them off. I will never understand why films decisively killed off their villains. Tim Burton started it in the first Batman when Joker fell into concrete.
Right.
Because he always fell, in the comic books, he always fell into water. This geek moment has been brought to you by thematinee.ca.
Same.
But same thing. In Spider-Man 3, they were killing off villains. Peter Parker was dancing. Peter Parker had emo bangs. The movie seemed to go on for like 3 hours. After where we had been just 2 years previous, maybe not all that long before, I could not believe that this is where everybody had gone. When they brought the news down not long ago that everybody who was involved with it was bailing out and that they were going to reboot, they were giving it over to Mark Webb, Andrew Garfield's going to take it over, I could not have been happier. Because while that series had nowhere to go but up, they left it just in flames with Spider-Man 3. I've never understood this. From a studio perspective, if you want to keep a franchise going, think to yourself, okay, here's the character. Who's his enemies? He's got five main guys? Great, we got five movies.
Right.
We'll have a little bit of crossover from the guy before, but not much.
It doesn't have to be like a heroin dose. You need to have the bigger one each time.
Right.
You just have like a nice, great movie that you can get into. I mean, we say this, but The Dark Knight actually followed that formula as well, but it just did it in moderation.
Yeah, and you know, plus The Dark Knight had, there was the main villain, and then there was the guy who turns into the villain. Spoilers for The Dark Knight. You know, he was a character who evolves into something different. They did it in Batman Begins as well. Jonathan Crane evolves into something different over the course of the film. You have one heel. You have somebody else on the side who, you know, has their own little arc. But you don't have Sandman, Hobgoblin, and then Venom, and oh yeah, we've got a bad Spider-Man too.
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
They should have just done it with the Sandman.
Yes!
It had a similar feel.
And had him not dance and trimmed his bangs.
I was thinking that it was possible that I might even dreamt that he was actually doing his little Saturday Night Fever on the street.
No, you didn't. So that's mine. What's your next one? We're getting down towards the end here.
Number two. Now this one stings really badly because it's two films. This film's from my favorite director, Terry Gilliam's Brothers Grimm / Tideland, which were basically made simultaneously. Gilliam made Tideland while he was taking a break from making Brothers Grimm and getting too much hassle from the studios.
No. that never happens.
It was interesting. He made Tideland in Manitoba, and it had Jeff Bridges in it, you know, so it seemed like it had a recipe for success. It was about a guy, well, one of the characters was fighting a really crazy heroin addiction, so it had this great opportunity for hallucinations and all that. And there were some in there, and that kind of went a couple of places, but in the end, the film was unfocused, and you could tell it was made in a rush. Same problem with Brothers Grimm is that we had this great, vast repository of characters and stories to draw upon, and you have the guy who would be the perfect guy to handle some fairy tales in a very spectacularly visual fashion, and he's finally using some non-practical special effects. He's finally using some CG, and I guess maybe that was the thing that made it all go off the rails. Between the studio involvement and him trying new techniques of filmmaking and the fact that Matt Damon was just not on his game, nor was Heath Ledger. It was the first film where I really felt that my hero, Gilliam, had flaws and that I could no longer defend him in any situation. So maybe that hurt me more, that I had to realize, had to make a realization on my own that I had changed, I had outgrown a hero of mine. But it was just such a
you're misting me up over here. You know,
it just fell apart. It was just watching it, and like I was ready with my childlike wonder. I finally pulled it up and was ready to watch a movie with those eyes. And I just as I went through it, just progressively got worse and worse, and I just couldn't forgive the film.
And these were like one year after the other too, weren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah,
yeah. That would be a huge betrayal. Has he done anything since Imaginarium?
Gilliam, no.
But that brought him back up a little.
I didn't
really
like it, but
wow.
I have to watch it again now that I've come to understand Andrew Garfield a little bit more.
Okay.
I mean, he's now going to try and do Don Quixote again. So we'll see.
He knows there's a documentary about what happened last time,
yes,
right? Yes. I see. Well, my next one is kind of a specific one, and I'm not going to spend too much time on it because I kind of talked about this once or twice before. My next one is a film called All the King's Men, which was 2006. Starred Sean Penn, Jude Law, I think Mark Ruffalo's in that. Patricia Clarkson is in that. James Gandolfini. Mm. And it is a remake of a Best Picture winner from the 50s called All the King's Men, and He's a candidate. Actually, it's kind of cool that we're talking about it on the Ides of March show because he's a candidate. He's running for office, and he starts out from very wholesome beginnings. And of course, he, like many politicians do, he gets corrupted. The reason why this is on my betrayal list is because this was a TIFF selection.
Oh.
So TIFF, first of all, you're hoping for higher quality films, which doesn't always happen. Second of all, a lot of people, especially me, are seeing it with very, very little detail. Some of these things don't have trailers. You're going off a write-up. You're kind of, in a lot of ways, it can be fun because you're going to it in the dark. It worked out great for me with Ides of March, mm-hmm. but my God, can it backfire? And that was this moment. That was a slot. That was 2 hours where I would have easily had something like four other things to choose from. And I chose this one based on all these factors. And it let me down. So for the fact, it embodies for me film festival disappointments. As much as I extol the virtues of going to film festivals and talking with people and seeing these movies that you might not otherwise see, it's always possible that you might be in for a rough ride.
Youch. I have not seen the film. I think I deliberately stayed away from it.
Don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It faded into obscurity fairly fast. It was funny because coming into the festival, it seemed to hold some sort of Oscar buzz. Because you have that many candidates, there's that many quality actors in one project. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of drama. And this thing withered on the vine in a real big hurry.
It really bothers me when I go to a film festival and there's a film that I see and I can see that it was picked because of the numbers. It's picked because, okay, it was made by this person or it was from this country or it was on this subject.
Yeah.
But it's not really judged on its merits so much.
Yeah. So we're down to your last one. What is your big, big film betrayal?
And this is a major one because nobody else feels the same way. Although maybe you will when I'm done. But nobody
that's right, I have a choice.
Really understands what I'm talking about when I say it. But Hellboy 2 was the biggest betrayal I've ever felt by a film. Most especially because, I mean, my expectations were so high because the first film was so incredibly good.
This might be our biggest argument since Mad Men.
I mean, the cast in it was great. They were it was a great cast of actors. They were well cast as those characters. It had an incredible director whose star somehow managed to still be on the rise despite being already, like, so high. It was catching him right in the fever pitch of all of the things that were going on with him. It's Hellboy 2 was just such a letdown because it had so much possibility and it squandered it for all of the wrong reasons. Hellboy 2 changed characters, like their actual personalities. For instance, Jeffrey Tambor's is the most glaring example of a change. He went from the officious, antagonistic boss character to the sycophantic.
But his job was usurped. Whiny. They brought in Klaus.
Yeah, his job was usurped, so they had to change him. They had to get him out of an authority personality in order to let somebody else have authority.
Okay.
But instead, he would still maintain the same attitude over the person who he is in charge of, and he is still in charge of him. He was chasing after him like, hey, Hellboy, I need to talk to you, instead of like, you are getting locked up right now.
It's a pretty good Jeffrey Tambor,
so,
actually.
Absolutely. Like, so that really bothered me. I felt offended by the presence of Seth MacFarlane doing a German accent.
Yeah.
So he was basically doing the goldfish from American Dad.
Yeah.
In this, like, they couldn't have got a German guy to do it. I just couldn't.
Germans are expensive.
The whole film seemed to think that it could get by on its production design, because everybody's like, oh, yeah, but it's Guillermo, and oh, that whole market scene looked so good, and oh, the Angel of Death was so cool, and all, like, yeah, sure, there was a lot of things that looked really good, but that was strictly the production design. The things that happened within that production design were ridiculous. The questioning scenes of they're talking to the people in the market, they were all hackneyed, stupid, obvious jokes. The goblin guy on his little wheels with his little push around cart thing, his like interest in shiny things, that's straight out of Secret of Nim, actually. It was just that was also very obvious. I mean, there was so much that was going on there that I just had to roll my eyes at. I respected the fact that they wanted to give Doug Jones his due and let him voice the character that he actually acted out in the first film.
Right.
But David Hyde Pierce was so much better. It was odd.
And he sounded just enough like him, but still not quite.
Exactly. Yeah? And that made it so much more frustrating.
Oh, wow.
And finally, this bothers me the most, even though it occupied the smallest amount of time in the film, was young Hellboy's stupid buck teeth. That he had these giant teeth, and it was cute, and I'm sure that's exactly how he looked like in the comic book. But if he's got buck teeth that he can't close his mouth, you have to make him sound like he can't close his mouth. He did, like, it was just such an example of poor dubbing, looping of a voice.
Right.
The kid was a puppet, except it was a kid. So I felt that if they were going to do the buck teeth, they had to actually make them functional. A kid had to be able to either close his mouth or talk like he couldn't close his mouth.
I dig that movie.
I love that man.
No, I dig that movie. I was going to say, there's a copy behind me, which I'm kind of trying to hide at this point.
I own it too. I own it.
Wait a minute though. If you own it, how can it have betrayed you?
Oh, it betrayed me. I'm a complicated man.
Clearly. We talked about directors losing it, and that actually, this is probably biggest example. My biggest film betrayal, one of the worst films I have seen since I started writing the Dark of the Matinee and then the Matinee.ca in 2007 is Oliver Stone's W. Now, for those of you who have rightfully put this film out of your memory, it came out in 2008, and it was Oliver Stone's take on the Bush presidency. Now, this, first of all, came across really, really ballsy, because I don't believe that until films of a sitting president are few and far between. Certainly a biopic of a sitting president are very few and very far between.
Or like a documentary about the assassination of said president.
Well, there's that. And even that was a letdown, but that's a whole other show. Because that one, for everything that was supposed to be, that was not what that was. Oliver Stone, for those who may not remember, made his bones by being a very, very controversial director. He suggested conspiracy theories. He shined a light on some of our worst things as a society. From about 86 to 94, he was one of, if not the top director in terms of controversy, in terms of his projects.
Yeah, he was Michael Moore, but not a documentarian.
Right, yeah. He was making fictional stuff, be it JFK, be it Born on the 4th of July. He won 2 Oscars in that time. There's very few directors who have 2 Oscars or more, and he's one of them.
Yep.
So, he makes W. He takes one of the most controversial presidents of all time. Whether you're right, whether you're left, there is nothing you can say that will take the shine off the Bush apple at this point. And he tells us nothing. He suggests nothing. He gets all these actors who look a lot like the real-life people they are portraying, and he has us in the war room in a 2-hour film for probably a grand total of 5 minutes. Once when they're planning to go into Iraq and once when they figure out what they've done. And that's all. And there's the shortest moment between Dreyfus as Dick Cheney and Jeffrey Wright as Colin Powell that is fan-friggin-tastic and just gives you that little taste, that smallest lick of what this film should have been. And it is nowhere near it. And it is just the grossest miscalculation I could ever see. I gave this thing 1 star out of 4. And I barely get down below 1.5 or 2. And this is a 1 star. Like, A month later, I gave Twilight the same damn score. That's how much I hated this film. Because Bush is at the end of his presidency. If you're going to fire something controversial, you're going to do it now. You're going to have everybody listening. Certainly the guy who made all these suggestions about what happened with the JFK assassination, certainly the person who made all these suggestions of what role media plays in violence.
Right.
He is going to take on this very, very contentious figure who in North America pretty much defined the damn decade. And he has no balls to do anything. He gives us what we've seen on CNN for 8 years and doesn't think for a second, hey, everybody's seen this on CNN for 8 years. I felt so friggin' ripped off.
Well, do you really think that, like, if the film had some really controversial things that it would have gotten made?
It's at the end of his presidency. They had nothing to lose at that point. Even, like, the thing is, like, not to get off on too far of a political tangent, but even the Republicans that were running to succeed Bush in the next term, even they were distancing themselves from Bush at that time.
But perhaps...
And this thing came down the pipe fast. It's not like he had this script knocking around for 6 or 7 years trying to get it made. This script showed up in late 07, and they filmed it in record time to get it out for the fall of 08.
For me, my impression of how the film was, it was more of it was an apologist. It was sort of like, well, this is what George's thing was like life was like here, and this is why his life was like here, and these are some of the reasons for why he did these things, and this is probably the controversial thing to do in the face of such popular opinion against Bush. The controversial thing is to actually make a film that actually maybe tries to explain a little bit and maybe tries to sympathize.
But it didn't explain shit. It was everything we already knew. That's the problem is now we're in an information age. Like the 8 years leading into this, we've been able to find more and more and more information. This is before even like, you know, a WikiLeaks age. This is just everything now seems to be public domain. You know, his trouble with alcoholism, his inferiority to his father, his work with the Texas Rangers and as the governor of Texas, we knew all of this. There was no, like, there was very little conversations with
his wife.
But
how could there be more stuff for somebody who's been so scrutinized?
Yeah, Make it up! Just...
That, and therefore he could not do that.
I don't know, just... Suggest something. I don't know. To try something different. Don't tell me what I already know and again make me pay $10 for the privilege. especially given who he is and his track record for what he's done. He took a decade off, really. If you go all the way back to you can say what you will for Any Given Sunday. I'm not really a fan of it.
I like it.
Okay. So that was really his last good film. Since then, he's done shit. And this is a guy, you know, he was once, as I said, he was once an A1 director. He's one of the very few to have two Oscars, and he has done nothing in 10 years. So that's unfortunate. And that is my film betrayal. You know, there's a lot that leads to this, I think, is the end of it. Sometimes there's expectations. There's a source material. There's, you know, the time and money we dedicate to this. But I think... It goes above just saying that film was crap.
Mm.
You know, I guess it's kind of the point of the betrayal conversation.
Right.
I think people like us who care about movies and have these kind of memories, it stings a little bit more.
Well, I think people would look at us with incredulity, saying like, why do you let it get you so riled up? Like, don't let it get you riled up. Well, no. Like... We're in love with movies.
Yes.
When you're in love, you do crazy things, and you want to get riled up.
That's right.
Like, why are you taking it so seriously? Well, I take it seriously.
That's right.
And well, don't take it so seriously. Well, I have to.
Yeah.
Because this is what we do as film lovers. So,
that's right.
Yeah, and when you let them in your heart...
You're going to get your heart broken.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Well, that is all for this episode of the Matinee Cast. Come on back for episode 45 on November 7th. We will be talking about Johnny Depp's new film, The Rum Diary. Gonna see that?
I am gonna see that. I'm looking for it as a sort of sidequel kind of Fear and Loathing thing.
That's very, very true.
Very exciting.
So you're not so much writing for Man I Love Films anymore
at the moment.
But there is a lot of your material there to be found on manilovefilms.com.
Yes, there is.
There is, of course, still material to be found of your writing on filmcynics.com.
It still exists.
Attaboy. And if people want to find new material on Twitter, where can they find you?
I'm Steve the Cynic. That's me on Twitter.
There we go. Follow him. He's good. He's got stuff to say, and sometimes he'll entertain you with pictures of poutine. My own blog is thematinee.ca, which Steve very, very helpfully helped me design. So, again, one more time, thank you very, very much for that. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes of this show on thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can find them on mypodcast.com, on Blueberry, and the iTunes Music Store. They all give you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on the Ides of March, on your experiences of film betrayal, and of course on whether or not you think I should get spoilerific on the reviews can be sent to ryan@thematinee.ca, facebook.com/darkmatinee, or Twitter, thematinee_ca. Any last thoughts?
Thanks for having me, man. Good times.
Good luck on the apartment search. For Steve the Cynic, I'm Ryan McNeil. We'll see you at the matinee.